Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. The Iowa caucuses today mark the official start to the presidential primary season. I know, it seems like it's been going on forever. But Ohio Governor and GOP presidential primary candidate John Kasich isn't in the Hawkeye State, where polls put him in seventh place, or at least certain polls. Instead, he's in New Hampshire rallying the troops there for the primary next week. That's what we're talking about today on our weekly reporters roundtable, presidential politics. Joining us, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Welcome, as always, Laura.
So glad to be here.
And Julie Karsmai, State House correspondent for the Associated Press. Welcome.
Good morning, Ann.
And Jim Siegel, State House reporter for the Columbus Dispatch. Welcome to you as well.
Welcome. Good to be here.
The New York Times released an editorial backing Governor John Kasich for the Republican nomination for president and calling him the most plausible candidate, I think is the way they put it. The Boston Globe has backed him. We were joking earlier, what's next, Mother Jones? But Laura Bischoff, really, what is the significance of something like that?
Well, I understand that over the weekend he's been going to all his, I think he had his 84th, 85th, 86th town hall in New Hampshire, and he's been embracing this endorsement from the New York Times. I think when asked about it, he says, you know, it's nice to have everybody for you. I don't think it's going to help him with evangelical, hard-right conservatives. Not at all. Generally, I would say bashing the New York Times editorial page is a favorite pastime
yeah.
for them. But I think it'll help him in a general election if he can actually get that far.
Right. But it doesn't an endorsement in a primary does not a general election endorsement make.
That's right. Yeah. And you have to be cognizant of the fact that these are very specific endorsements. I think the Boston Globe endorsement was specific to New Hampshire, saying
okay.
he would be a good choice for New Hampshire voters. And so you have to watch that this isn't saying John Kasich would be the best in the general election. I'm sure a different endorsement will come down the line as this field finally narrows. I do think that the timing is good for him for what he wants to do in New Hampshire, which is a top-tier win, he said. Some polls have him at second or third. Those numbers move daily, but that would be a good thing for him. But then he has to hit South Carolina, where folks, as Laura says, don't think too highly of the New York Times.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and don't forget the Boston Globe last election endorsed John Huntsman.
Okey-dokey.
And we know how well that went. So it doesn't necessarily translate, but I know he's, you know, it's good to have, I think he's right. It's good to have these, you know, these folks for you. I think he also has the vast majority of the papers in New Hampshire,
right.
some of which are pretty small, but still he definitely has way more than anyone else in terms of endorsements from papers inside the state. And certain folks definitely do like his message, at least those editorial pages do. And we'll see if it translates into the voters. He's still gunning for second place. That's he and just about everybody else in that field right now.
Right.
Because it looks like Trump's just pulling away with it right now.
And he's also been saying, he's been quoting the editorial saying, a line from it saying something along the lines of, make no mistake, he is a true conservative. He fought the public sector unions. He is... move to restrict access to abortion. He's cut taxes, et cetera. So,
mm-hmm.
You know, even though the New York Times loves him, he still is a conservative.
You're listening to All Sides with Dan Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about Republican politics, I guess presidential politics in general, with our weekly reporters roundtable, Julie Karsmai of the Associated Press, Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, and Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News. Tell us what you think, 614-292-8513, and you can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, he's not even in Iowa today. I think Hillary Clinton, Bernie Sanders, Ted Cruz, Donald Trump, they're all in Iowa.
I think that Kasich definitely has put all of his eggs in this New Hampshire basket. He doesn't expect to do particularly well. He does have some surrogates out there. He's got the lieutenant governor, I think, the state auditor, the Senate president, Keith Faber, who's been behind him all the way.
So they're all out in New Hampshire or in Iowa?
I think they're in Iowa.
Okay.
His speaker lineup out mm-hmm. there. So he's... You know, he's trying to get what votes that he can, but it's a really labor-intensive process. And I think I heard when Donald Trump say earlier in the weekend that it's been 16 years since they actually picked a winner in those caucuses. What it does is it provides some momentum for a candidate and some name ID that maybe can be useful.
In general, for a primary, it's the true blues, the hardcore party people that show up for primaries. With the caucus, it's even more refined.
Right. And
because it's so much more work.
The voting is done in like gymnasiums and churches and even people's living rooms. And they're picking delegates to go to the to be delegates to the county, and then the county parties pick delegates to the state. And it's a much more quirky process. That's the ballots are not counted by government officials, they're counted by party officials.
Right.
So, you know, there's the other thing is like these, and there have been stories written about this, about how the voters in Iowa are extremely to the right, evangelical, and they kind of hold an outsized influence over this whole presidential, mm-hmm. pick the presidential candidate process. The same could be said for a small New England town or state of New Hampshire. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are people who say we should change the process. Of course, Iowa and New Hampshire really like the process. They like the attention.
Yeah, I mean, remember in 2008, Mike Huckabee won Iowa, and obviously he didn't come close to getting the nomination. Rick Santorum won 4 years ago. Now, he hung around for a while, but obviously lost. And so, you know, they're right. It's been back since the last time they picked a contested winner was George W. Bush in 2000. When he beat a Steve Forbes. But it's, you know, it's a population that, you know, for a guy like Kasich, he doesn't need to win Iowa. That's not his group. I mean, you know, and I think he's definitely smart to put all his efforts into New Hampshire, which is a more moderate type of an electorate for him. One, you know, he'll be lucky to probably get, if he gets 5% of the vote in Iowa, he'll probably be happy, mm-hmm. At least the way the polls are going. But, you know, it's just not, and it's right, it's not representative of anything in this country. It's way more evangelical, white, and rural than the country as a whole.
What do you make of the evangelical support then for Donald Trump, who I never would have pegged for a candidate for them?
I feel that that group is among those who feel pretty disenfranchised with just the status quo. If you look at both sides, the far left and the far right, there are a lot of things that are making people nervous that are happening in the country. Definitely on the evangelical side, things like legalizing gay marriage and
He's not opposed to that.
Right.
He supports gay marriage.
Right. I think it's going to be a vote, though, against everything sort of status quo. I mean, and we're seeing it on both sides. I mean, Bernie Sanders supporters are the same way. I think that they just don't feel that establishment candidates are hearing them. And I suspect that's part of where they're coming down on their candidate.
It is sort of baffling, though, because you know, he's a guy who's been divorced multiple times. I don't get the appeal for the evangelicals.
I don't think of him as necessarily a religious person.
No, but I do think that I think Julie's right in that I think he appeals to the anti-establishment, the disenfranchised, the people who are kind of angry at the status quo. I think that's why he's got a lot of momentum with that crowd.
There's a stylistic thing, too. I mean, he's just a very no-nonsense, says what he thinks. There's a certain American demographic that just says, you know, I'm tired of politicians mm-hmm. who are so handled and, mm-hmm. and who are giving me the line and not answering the question. You hear it all the time on, you know, when you're listening to the political shows and that kind of thing, where people just aren't really speaking their minds, and there's a sense that he's very authentic. Take him or leave him, but he's a very authentic person.
Yeah. You know, I didn't check, and I'm surprised at myself for not checking, because I actually stayed up and listened to it, but I'm wondering about the ratings for that last debate with Donald Trump not being in on him. Jim Siegel, did you check on that, whether there was anything noticeably different?
I kept seeing conflicting reports as to whether it was better or worse. without him there. I don't know.
It was more interesting.
I didn't read into it that hard, to be honest with you, but I just saw different headlines popping up about some saying it was better, and some saying, you know, depending on what you were comparing it to, and it wasn't as good. I don't know.
Well, based on just what I heard the next morning on news shows, it was really interesting that they were still talking about Trump, even though he wasn't there. And then there were a few references to Cruz and Rubio going at it. And
oh, yeah, they went back and forth.
Right. But, I mean, they weren't – it wasn't as if there was any wall-to-wall coverage of that debate, period, the next day. It was all about the point-counterpoint and who had gone to Trump's and who hadn't. And he made news again by distracting from
not being there,
process.
Right. Right.
Yeah, I like that Santorum and Huckabee showed up at Trump's event to speak at Trump's podium. Sort of like Trump said, "Hey, everyone who's out of money and still in this race, come on over and join me at my party
and get some free airtime."
Right.
Did any of you watch the debate? No. All right. Well, I did, and I was hoping to get some feedback on what you thought. I mean, it seems like John Kasich really fell through the crack again.
Well, he keeps trying to stand out as the pragmatic conservative Republican up there, or not conservative, compassionate Republican up there, which is fine. I think he does stand out for that. However, that doesn't draw anybody's attention when it comes to who you're going to be talking about the next day on the morning shows, or who you're going to be writing about in your columns. So, I think that's part of the reason why he continues to, despite the fact that he seems to get no attention at all after these debates from the media,
right?
He continues to poll. You know, he's right there in that mix of second place, which there's like four of them there.
Mm-hmm.
But he's still there because I think there are people watching the debate who aren't in the political class and in the media who kind of like what he says and find him to be somewhat refreshing when compared to the others on the stage who. Many of whom are often playing to fears and speaking very very down about the way things are going, and he likes to try to provide some kind of an uplifting message, which is different. But again, it just doesn't get you a lot of headlines.
Well, it's difficult in a debate format to stay positive and kind of play that role that he wants, that he's going to bring everybody together, and he's and then. It means he can't throw punches. And if you don't throw punches, then you don't get in the headlines. I think it's unfortunate because I think a lot of the coverage has all been horse race coverage, all about the strategy of who's going to win which state and how they're appealing in this way or that way. And you hear less about their backgrounds and who they are and who's backing them and what kind of policies they've pursued in the past and what they're likely to do in the future.
And I think that for journalists, it's a challenge when you think about having initially 16. Now I think maybe we're down to 12 or 10. But, you know, it's very difficult to do anything then but talk about the top two who are disputing each other on some particular issue or taking each other on because, then you get a paragraph on each person in your story that says, and then here's how he had distinguished himself and here's how he distinguished himself. And, you know, they're still trying. I know that we run at AP, we run sort of a latest, we do little briefs all night long, sort of a Twitter type effect of, everything that's going on as they go. But then when the final story gets written, the arc is often about something that Trump has done or not done.
We will continue our conversation about presidential politics with our weekly Reporters Roundtable. Today's the Iowa caucus. Next week, the New Hampshire primary. John Kasich, Ohio's governor, is still in the running for the GOP presidential nomination. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. With me in the studio for our weekly Reporters Roundtable, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Jim Siegel of Columbus Dispatch. What do you think about the presidential political scene right now? Give us a call, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. Now, this is a real issue. Jack Torrey of the Dispatch wrote, I think, was it Sunday or today, that the super PAC for Kasich is falling way short, hovering around $5 million if you count what they say they raised in January, but still far behind the Bush PAC, which ended the year with $58.6 million. I mean, that's crazy amounts of money and crazy disparity. Does money really matter at this point? Of course, in a place like New Hampshire, where you can just ride around in a bus, it doesn't. It's small. But once even you get to South Carolina, it's going to be tough.
I think... honestly, myself, I feel like the bus has already out of the station, or trains out of the station on Jeb Bush. I just feel like people, he's the one quantity they know, and the more he's gone.
He did pretty well in the last debate, too. Mm-hmm. I mean, such as it was. Mm-hmm. But you're saying he's got the money to last.
I'm saying the opposite. I just feel like if he would have really surged, if he were going to surge, and he'd be up ahead of Trump. And that's just my take. I did hear him speak when he was in Ohio.
You mean he can't buy this no matter how much?
I don't think so.
Yeah, he's just kind of wallowing. He hasn't really broken out at all. And no matter how much money he's got, it doesn't seem like it's really going to catch fire for him. I do think that Kasich's plan is to... do really well in New Hampshire, and then that will get him some momentum and some more money to, live another day and go on to South Carolina and the other primary states. We'll see. I think there was a report over the weekend that New Day for America, which is Kasich's PAC, raised $4 million in 3 months, and it came from just six wealthy donors.
Right.
That's some sugar daddy right there. Mm-hmm.
That's some sugar daddy.
I believe Les Wexner was one of them.
Well, Abigail.
Actually,
Abigail.
Or Abigail Wexner. Mm-hmm.
And
some John Wall McConnell Street. And some others.
Some hedge fund managers.
Some hedge fund managers, a couple of them. Mm-hmm. Gave a bunch of money.
Yeah, I don't think it's so important that what Kasich has right now. I think even if he has $4 million left, that's enough money to run ads in New Hampshire. He'll be fine. The key for him is, and frankly for a lot of these guys, Chris Christie, Rubio and others, is how do they place in New Hampshire? If there's a muddled finish where you have three or four of them all within 1 or 2 points of each other for second place, I don't know. Because the key is, where does the money go after New Hampshire? And Kasich is hoping that he pulls out a solid second place finish behind Trump, and the money from the establishment sector starts flowing towards him, and you can quickly rebuild your war chest that way. Mm-hmm. However, if there's no clear winner, or if Kasich finishes, a couple points behind second place, I mean, he's pretty much already said if he doesn't do well enough in New Hampshire, he's finished. And I don't think there's much doubt about that. So, but the same goes for the other candidates as well. You're Chris Christie, Bush, Rubio, Cruz. I mean, if any one of them or multiple of them fall behind the others, the money's going to start to dry up.
So far, Donald Trump is the by far front runner in the GOP presidential primary. Bob in Columbus, you have a what if question.
Good morning, all.
Morning.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
Question: what if the Donald becomes the president? What will the Congress reaction be to him and cooperation? Because he's made a lot of things, a lot of promises, and I think a lot of enemies down in Congress. And I'd like to know what you guys think would be the cooperation to get any of these things done.
I'm just trying to imagine
the Donald as the president?
Yeah, the inaugural address.
The inaugural.
I just hope he puts his name up on the White House, like the Trump White House.
Yeah.
I mean, I think it depends on what he proposes, what he does out of the gate. That's a lot of it. And, I mean, they're not going to be happy about it either side, but... I mean, they've had a lot of practice not working with a president for the last 8 years. So it's not like they're suddenly going to turn around and be cordial to whoever gets elected. But I think they're going to look to see if he appears to be serious or not, if that were the case.
But I think that the establishment Republicans in Congress, they've said they'll back the GOP nominee, but I think they're holding their nose the whole way if it's going to be Trump.
Mm-hmm. I think it could be very surprising that Congress might take a more leading role in policy in the country. I mean, he is coming at this as a complete novice in terms of how to run a government. And it's possible that they bring things to him more because he won't have that sort of background that the last few presidents have had.
Okay, Bob, we shall see if Donald Trump is the nominee. You're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Somebody wrote about too many polls. Too many polls are out there. And it does seem like they're becoming much more liberal about mentioning how they're doing in the polls. Julie Carsmite.
I was just going to say, I think that is true. And I think some of the words you're hearing come from us, like baffling and surprising. I mean, I think everybody's desperate to figure out what the public opinion is and where that's going to coalesce. And so every little poll is being looked to as some kind of a clue. But I know for us at AP, we're very judicious in how often we even will cite a poll, period. And if you put in margins of error in some of these, they don't say anything at all.
Well, and particularly primary polls, you're already dealing with a smaller group of people right off the bat, and then you reduce it to a state.
Right. You reduce it to a state, and then you reduce it to a single candidate out of 10.
Yeah.
And it, by the time you get the margin of error in there, it really isn't telling you very much. As Jim says, it'll be really interesting if it turns out that they're all within a handful of votes of each other.
Mm-hmm. What I always wonder these days, who's answering poll calls?
I don't answer any phone numbers.
Whenever a pollster calls, you can see it on your phone that it's either an unknown number or it comes up as some type of a polling firm that's mm-hmm. name pops up. A lot of people these days don't have home phones anymore. They have cell phones. And it's just, I don't know. I always wonder who's getting sampled these days. Considering the, you know, just the way things are.
I also think that that a lot of people turn to Real Clear Politics, which has sort of a composite poll for New Hampshire, for Ohio, for Iowa, and for the nation. But they're blobbing together all these different polls that have different methodologies, different margins of error. And I don't think it's all that reliable. It's more like a guideline, but it's not really a predictor. And I also think that even in the primaries, even though voting is today, there's still a lot of people that are still undecided in Iowa. Mm-hmm. And even though New Hampshire is 8 or 9 days out, they're still undecided.
Any sense about where the that means the independent vote is so important, because in New Hampshire they can vote, like in Ohio, you can switch back and forth between primaries at will. You know, you can't vote in both primaries in 1 year, but from every, you know, 4 years you can switch around. Any sense about who is appealing to that independent streak in New Hampshire?
Well, I think Kasich is trying to appeal to the independents, and I think that Trump will be getting some of the independents, but
and likewise Bernie Sanders on the Democrat side, because what they're really doing is competing for with Democrats for those independents.
Right. I also think in New Hampshire, Bernie Sanders gets the neighbor vote because he's from Vermont.
Vermont, right.
The other thing is with New Hampshire, well, really with the Republicans in general, I mean, a victory here is something like 16%. It's not 51%. It's not anywhere close. And so when you say who the independents are for, maybe 2% and maybe 3 or 4 or 5 for Trump. You know, it's not going to be decisive, in my opinion.
Let's move on, unless there's some burning issue regarding presidential politics you want to cover, and I have not. I wanted to turn to more local stories, including the Ohio Senate vote to defund Planned Parenthood or zero out funding for Planned Parenthood, depending on how you want to put it. Has it gone back to the House for approval of those changes? I mean, ultimately, it's going to make it to Governor Kasich's desk.
Right. The bill went back to – it needs a concurrence vote in the House, and they adjourned before they took it up.
Mm-hmm. So I don't think it's going to Kasich's desk before New Hampshire.
Before the primary.
Right.
Is that important?
I don't know. I mean, New Hampshire was the third state in the country to pass this similar measure.
Okay.
When, you know, this defunding Planned Parenthood. Now, does that mean that it doesn't necessarily mean it polls well there? It's just, you
that's
know –
what the legislature
That's what
did.
The legislature and governor decided to do. But Yeah, I mean, it's not going to get to him. I know he has his office indicated he will sign it whenever it does. It is curious why it has not reached his desk yet. This bill has now passed three times this session, and is still not on his desk.
They never get anything done that much in one session.
And still not on his desk. So, you know, I don't know. Maybe there's someone deciding this is it's better timing to wait till after New Hampshire and before South Carolina. Mm-hmm. Maybe it's just the way the timing worked out. I don't know. But it is curious that a bill that everyone in the majority supports still has not managed to make it to him, even though it was introduced 4 months ago and has passed three times.
Yeah. How much money are we talking about now?
I think it's like $1.4 million. They've already kind of put Planned Parenthood at the end of the line for priority for funding. So as State Senator Bill Seitz of Cincinnati said in the floor debate during one of the times that they passed this bill, you know, he said that this is just the last step. We've already done a lot of defunding of Planned Parenthood already. So I think this is the final chunk of change.
Mm-hmm. And the issue of fetal remains, of course, this is what triggered the latest round of anger against Planned Parenthood. But it's been shown. In fact, they have indicted, I think. Is that the word? The right word? The perpetrators of that film that led a lot of people to question what was being done with fetal remains. Two House bills in Ohio are pending on this topic. What are they and how are the opponents responding? What's going on?
Well, at least one of them would say that you have to, wouldn't it codify that you have to dispose of fetal remains in a humane
manner? Which is already in the state rules, but it's undefined.
Right. Yeah. And so it's trying to assure that abortion remains, I mean, it's singling out abortion remains for treatment because those are not those right now are sort of commingled in the law with hospital waste, and that gets very, very complicated.
And okay. I think it would require cremation or burial with a death certificate for aborted remains. You know, a lot of this was sparked because Attorney General Mike DeWine, after the undercover videos came out against Planned Parenthood, the undercover videos that have now
been faked,
were heavily edited, yeah, and et cetera. Then the Attorney General's office did a big investigation about what's going on in Ohio. And Mike DeWine came out with a report that said that these remains are going off to the landfill. And it kind of really sparked a lot of outrage among the anti-abortion crowd. And so these two bills, House Bill 417 and 419, would, you know, make these new requirements. So what I think is interesting is that if they're going to treat aborted remains differently than,
say, a miscarriage. Yeah. Say a miscarriage, yeah, at a hospital.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right. No, I was thinking more of, you know, if you have an amputation.
Right.
I guess what they're trying to do is say that these aborted remains are more akin to a complete human, mm-hmm, than medical waste. And I think it's one more step toward trying to define a fetus as a human.
I do think the hospitals are raising some concerns about some of the definitions in here. And I think this is not going to go quite as smoothly as some had hoped. I think they're going to need to work out a few technicalities on, you know, cremation versus incineration, things of that nature, which to the average person may not sound terribly different, but apparently, you know, in the law it can be. And so I've been told there's some issues being raised about that kind of thing.
There's also issues being raised about the women's privacy and whether or not this is going to, mm-hmm, would open the door to determining, you know, who had abortions. Right now, there are abortion reports that go to the Ohio Department of Health, but they're devoid of identifying information. So it's more statistical.
And when there's a choice given about what to do with the remains and the mother chooses, who pays? I mean, is there a cost associated with this? Has there been a fiscal note on this legislation yet?
That's a good question. I think that
I assume
I think that if you choose the option, then you pay for it.
Well, I think the facility pays, I believe.
Well, it's in the bill.
Unless there's some – unless the woman asks for something kind of out of the ordinary to be done with the remains, and then that cost would be borne by the woman. But I think most generally it's look, they're already doing disposal, so I'm not sure that cost is going to be a big issue for them. I mean, it's just a matter of making sure it's done in a way that everyone agrees to, that is a humane or however
and
they want to define it.
The women would not be given the choice to donate the fetal remains to science, like you can donate your body.
We don't allow that in Ohio. It's against state law at this point, so I don't.
But you can donate a body to science,
correct?
If you die.
But what I was told by Planned Parenthood when this whole thing started was that they don't have a fetal remains donation program because it's not allowed in Ohio. That's not the reason why, but that's an explanation for why. And I don't actually know how that dovetails with studying
human remains or
studying, you know, cells for research science. Gotcha. What am I trying to say?
Stem cell
research.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that's what we usually associate it with. Omar in Columbus, you're on the air. Hi, Omar.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, by the way. Long time listener. I haven't called you in a long time.
Okay.
Anyway, my actual question is, I just don't understand what the actual motivation or is to restrict abortion, because is it religion? Is it political gain? Because I know if it's religion, normally, if someone commits sin, isn't God's job to deal with that person rather than other people trying to deal with that person? Or are they trying to gain population? Or what is the motive for these things? Because I haven't seen anybody talk about
it. Yeah, we really haven't talked about motive in a long time. it's an interesting question, and it seems simplistic, but we don't talk about what's behind all of this actually. It depends. Omar, thanks for that call.
Well, I think that most anti-abortion people have a very strong belief that life begins at conception and that voluntarily terminating a pregnancy is akin to murder.
So in the same way that we outlaw murder, we should outlaw abortion. That's the way the argument goes.
So
in addition to that, though, I think that we can't step around the fact that it was introduced initially as a wedge political issue and has been used in that way. And those are the kinds of issues that people in politics understand are very divisive, and they raise them when they're trying to divide voters.
Okay. That's what we're going to say about that. We will continue our conversation with our political our reporters roundtable when we return. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. Welcome back to All Sides. I'm your host, Ann Fisher. It is our weekly Reporters Roundtable right now. If you have a question or comment about public policy, politics, State House, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org or check out our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. With me in the studio, Julie Carr-Smythe of the Associated Press, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, and Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch. Let's talk about the Ohio Democrats' economic agenda. They can all fit on the same stage now, I think, the entire Democratic caucus in the House and the Senate. Their priority legislation includes things like increasing the state minimum wage, paid family leave, using the state's rainy day fund to provide loans and grants to local governments, which is an interesting idea, and creating a legislative commission that studies the fiscal impact of the legislation that seeks to change Ohio's tax structure. I thought we already did have to know fiscal impacts of bills, but Laura Bischoff, Is this just spitting in the wind?
Yes.
Okay.
So, as you said, that the caucuses, the Democrats and the Senate, I think there's 10, and then the House, there's 34. So, yeah, they can all fit on one stage. Mm-hmm. They lack the power to really push through legislation that would increase the minimum age to, I think they want to have it at $10.10 an hour. They want to have paid leave for workers of like 12 weeks starting in 2020. They want to close the pay gap. I mean, these are all issues that appeal very much to the base, but they just don't have the power to push on that. I do think one thing they might have a little bit of traction on is they want to end taxes on diapers and feminine hygiene products.
Mm-hmm.
And, I think that's something that most families would see as a good thing.
But would Republicans?
Republicans, their babies use diapers too.
Yes.
The only issue there with Republicans is that Kasich has been pushing for an expansion of the sales tax in order to cut the income tax, and he has not been very excited about sales tax cuts of any kind. And so that would be the only thing I could see standing in the way of that. But I agree. I think they do use diapers and
they
such,
do.
And on all sides of the aisle.
On all sides. Not personally.
When you're in a minority party, these are the type of unveilings that you do to remind people what you would stand for if you were in the majority party.
Or if you had any clout whatsoever.
Right. And just to – they try to pick issues that they think are going to resonate with sort of a big wide swath of the middle, just so that they can be out there as having ideas and – then later on, when they don't pass, they can use them in campaigns. But no, the legislation being proposed by Democrats mostly at the moment isn't getting any traction.
But hey, it worked in some regards. Here we are talking about it.
True. What about Republicans? What are their priorities? Whatever they feel like doing, or how does that work?
I don't know. Well, they're. The sessions right now are there's not many voting sessions going right now.
Right.
And some of the things I know they're working on is they want to get a capital budget done.
They have to.
They don't have to.
Okay.
But they'd like to get that done before they leave in June. This is where they spend all their money on universities and prisons and various projects around the state to build infrastructure. Always a bill they like to do before they go home for and be able to talk about it at home. All the money they've brought back to the district, and they're talking. One of the most controversial things they're working on now deals with the unemployment compensation fund and mm-hmm. Who they're going to hit in order to make sure that fund remains solvent, going into the future. And right now, the bill critics, Democrats, and a number of labor groups and others are criticizing the bill heavily because it's weighted very much against workers. They would cut the number of down to 12 weeks the number of unemployment benefits you could get, the weeks of unemployment you could get,
making it the lowest in the country.
Yeah, we'd be tied for lowest in the country at that 12 weeks. And there's some other things there too that it seems to be all in benefit of business and hurting punishing workers, hurting the workers, according to the critics. And so there's still a lot of fight to be had on that one, but that's something I know they also want to see done.
The unemployment compensation fund, that I think there's about 50,000 workers, unemployed workers who rely on that for benefits each week. That fund has been in trouble for more than a decade. I mean, I remember writing about it 10 years ago that they've consistently had not enough money coming in and too much money going out.
And then when the recession hit,
then
boom.
it went broke, and right. Ohio ended up having to borrow money, I think over $1 billion from the feds. And there was some hope that the feds would kind of just forgive the loans to the states. They didn't. And Ohio's been paying interest on the loans, hundreds of millions of dollars mm-hmm. in interest on the loans and paying it down.
And that interest is costing businesses. Businesses are being charged.
Footing the bill for that.
Charged for that interest.
Oh, right. I thought it had to come out of the general fund for the interest.
Well, it does, but they businesses get charged like a surtax, I believe, on their unemployment compensation.
Isn't there a fundamental issue with how much money they're raising in the first place that kept them perennially kind of strapped?
Right. Well, Policy Matters Ohio, Zach Schiller has been kind of the lead critic of this and has been pounding away about how the fund is unbalanced, that there's not enough, that they should be taxing, having a higher base of the amount of how much money they tax in the, on the initial salaries of the workers. You know, the changes that they're proposing, Policy Matters says is not going to, it's not even going to solve the solvency problem. It's going to make it worse. So we'll see. I think that the House has decided that they want to do more work on the bill. So we'll see what kind of changes are coming.
Yeah, this has been an issue for years.
Yeah.
This is hardly new. The problem is that whenever they put together a group and they gum it over for a couple of years, they come up with a recommendation that in part almost always includes some type of increase tax on businesses, and the folks, just Republicans, don't want to do that. And so it just gets put by the, you know, it's, they've been kicking the can down the road now for so many years, and then the recession hit and we ended up, as Laura described, we ended up going bankrupt, having to borrow from the feds to keep the fund solvent, which you're required to do.
They also, besides making a play to lower the number of weeks, reduce the number of weeks for benefits, they're also making it harder in some cases for people to qualify for unemployment insurance in the first place.
They have, I don't know if it's changed in the current version of the bill, but they had a thing in there that if you violated anything in the employee handbook, you could be rendered ineligible for unemployment benefits. So that, I mean, there could be all kinds of picky things in a in an employee handbook that could get you if your employer really wanted to push it.
Wearing jeans on a Friday.
Yeah, wearing jeans on a Friday. I think that was one of the examples.
Really?
We have been hearing that the Senate is not particularly happy with the way the House bill has been crafted. So even if the House were to pass it in this way, I think the Senate is going to definitely do a lot of major rewriting of some of these provisions. There's another thing in there about at least a partial offset of Social Security that I know that some of the senators really don't like. So it's going to get a lot more discussion and changes.
One of the other things that is happening that'll be of interest this year is there was a big federal case on state boards and commissions. Essentially, it said that boards constructed, much like Ohio's board, say, the pharmacy board, the cosmetology board, the funeral board, that are controlled by the industry, run into some antitrust problems. So this decision came at about the same time that we have our Sunset Review Commission meeting, and they meet periodically to take a look at all of these boards and commissions and whether they've finished their work, done their job or not. And then they craft a big bill that kind of nicely sort of rewrites all the board and commission descriptions so that we don't have the ones that are obsolete. But this decision could be really impactful to us in every other state, because a lot have boards that the appointees are representatives of their own,
right,
of their own industry. So that would be an interesting one to watch.
We also don't know when the State of the State address is going to be, right, or where it's going to be. Maybe it'll be in Nashua, New Hampshire, or South Carolina.
Maybe.
Well, Kasich likes to move it out of Columbus.
There's
so
Buckeyes that live in South Carolina.
Right. I'm jesting, but
I know.
You know,
so
the governor's office has not indicated yet to the legislature where he would like to host it, or if he wants to. You know, return,
but he has to do this.
Yeah, it's required.
He has
and
to
usually
do.
It's in February, right?
Usually it is. And I know I think one of the legislative leaders said recently, well, I think Columbus is a nice place to hold a state of the state speech.
Do you think he might change up this new tradition and just to simplify it, have it in Columbus?
I think if he's still in the presidential race, there's a good chance of that, I think.
Well, I think if memory serves, I think he actually can submit it in writing. But I think it would be a really missed opportunity for somebody who's running for
president
to not give that speech and get all the media around it.
I also think he would open himself to huge criticism about how he's not really doing his job and he's phoning it in.
Which they readily admit he's phoning it
in. Or faxing it in this case.
Yeah, faxing it in. Emailing it. Emailing it in.
Yeah, right. Right. We've got some emails getting back now that we've, you know, slithered our way back to presidential politics. Email from George. Is it true that over the past 20 years, fewer than 20% of eligible voters have chosen to participate in the presidential primaries? Does this not show how incredibly weak and unpopular the candidates and parties are? They can spend huge amounts of money and get few people to support them. Thoughts?
I could say yes. I could also make an argument that people are pretty happy with who's been picked, and so they don't bother to show up. But generally, I think participatory democracy is the best way to have a representative government.
Yeah, and most years, a presidential primary is over within the first 10 or 12 states. It's generally decided. Now, that wasn't so much the case 4 years ago where – or not four, well, 4 years ago for the Republicans, 8 years ago for the Democrats as well, where that it kind of it lingered on, Clinton versus Obama mm-hmm. and Santorum versus Mitt Romney. But yeah, I mean, if by the time your state comes up and they're pretty much decided and there's nothing else you feel like going to the ballot for, then you just stay home. I mean, it could be indicative of they're not happy with the choices, but I think that's more of a general election turnout question.
Email from Linda. I've been both an R and a D, but right now I feel like I'm facing a Hobson's choice. My primary concern about Donald Trump being elected is not his ideas, but the fact that he meets the clinical definition of a bullying narcissist. This is a recipe for sure disaster if he were to become commander in chief. On the other hand, Congress won't work with the Democratic president, no matter who that is. So I guess Linda's thinking, you know.
She's hoping for Michael Bloomberg to get into the race is what she's hoping for.
Yeah, I mean, there could if it turns out that it's going to be Bernie versus Trump, I think that Michael Bloomberg will get in. There was a story last week about how his advisors are putting together a team and a plan to jump in. But, you know, we'll see. I really don't know if he'll get the nomination. I think it's 50-50 at this point. As the voting starts today in the first voting state. Mm-hmm.
I also think that there's an element of these huge rallies for Trump having a lot to do with the fact that he's a celebrity. It's like being invited to a rock concert and not having to pay. I mm-hmm. mean, just come on over and see someone you've seen on TV, see someone who's a cultural icon. Get a free t-shirt, and it doesn't necessarily translate to votes. Certainly outside of these early primary states, we have no idea whether these polls that we've been talking about that are all conglomerated, whether these are likely voters, certain voters, whether people's minds will be changed.
We're out of town. So we'll just save Brad's email for next time. And by this time next week, we'll know something, right?
Hopefully.
We'll know something.
Something.
In the meantime, Julie Carr Smyth of the Associated Press, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me.
Also, Laura Bischoff of the Dayton Daily News, thanks to you.
Thanks, Ann.
And Jim Siegel of the Columbus Dispatch, thanks to you.
Thank you.
Be sure to like All Sides on Facebook. You can follow the show on Twitter at WOSU All Sides. You can follow me on Twitter, too, at Ann Fisher WOSU. Thanks to the All Sides staff. Producer Michael DeBonis, associate producer Amy Jurevich, and assistant producer Shia Lanat, and our interns Summer Cartwright and Khalid Moalim and Sydney Schaefer. Thanks for listening. Once again, you're listening to All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.